You're listening to the Deep Purple Podcast, a fan podcast about one of the most legendary bands of all time, Deep Purple. We take a look at the music, history, and people behind the band Deep Purple and beyond.
Welcome to the Deep Purple Podcast, bonus episode number 2. Today's episode's a little different, and in this episode, I'm having a little talk with Tony Flynn, who we talked about in our episode on the new Deep Purple. And Tony had met up with Rod Evans, and in 1980, they embarked upon this new version of Deep Purple with a new lineup featuring Rod Evans, and Tony Flynn was on guitar. And if you want more information about that specific era, please check out our episode on the new Deep Purple, episode number 37. And I'm just going to kind of be setting up the stage here today for what we talked about and some of the things from Tony's background and that Tony worked on and into the music that he produced after he was playing together with the group with Rod. So here we go. Let's just get into it. Was a track that Tony had put together in 1980 in the studio, and Tony's been pretty prolific over the years, putting out a lot of different music, apart from what we heard in our previous episode about the new Deep Purple lineup. I was able to talk to Tony at some length about his career and his interest in music and his time with Rod Evans.
Hola, Nate. How are you doing?
Tony started off at the age of 5. Doing acting in a number of movies in the 60s, a series called The Lemon Grove Kids.
Hi, Larry.
What you doing, Pee-wee?
I'm gonna get muscles so I can be on you guys' team.
Fine. We'd be glad to have you.
Though it's not necessarily a time Tony remembers fondly.
It's about 60 of those kids' films, and, you know, it's just they edit and cut and give it a new title, and it was that time, you know. And then it led into I was in my teens, and I had my band, and I'm singing these horrible songs with the Lemon Grove Kids, and it's just, you know, all this crap's on YouTube. This is really bad stuff.
I asked Tony about his early guitar influences, and the number one influence was no surprise.
What the obvious, the B.B. King. That's the killer. I think even Carlos Santana will tell you that. It's the number one influence from the day. Yeah, you know, it's just, you have to be real. And we would all go out and see Chuck Berry play, and, you know, the really big groups at the Teenage Fair and Hullabaloo. I was living in Hollywood. It's another thing.
Tony was born in San Francisco, but moved to Hollywood at a young age. But eventually that would lead him to Mexico, where he still lives.
Started doing huge shows with a company called Musicas Amistad. And this is where I founded my career as a musician, as being a more serene place to work, a better place to work for me. And people respected me back in the day. So it was a much different world back then, much different.
So that really raises the question, doesn't it? How did Tony Flynn get involved with the new Deep Purple lineup?
Well, really, I didn't want to touch that with like a 10-foot pole, because I had already played with the fusion bands in 1972. Jan Siege and all the groups from Hollywood, you do the little California tours, the trendy stuff. And I had blown out from the blues rock bands. Let's just go through a little bit through this. I had played with McJohn with John Mayall, and that didn't work out because John wanted to paint a picture of a naked woman on his swimming pool. So the tour was canceled. So what the hell is that? And then this is 75. In 76, I'm playing with, you know, Paul Butterfield. And all they want to do is see Mike Bloomfield play live every night. That's the real beauty. So, you know, I went through that for a year, and then I was invited to the Last Waltz. And then I was playing with Dallas Taylor, Goldie McJohn. These are very famous people. And Dallas had some problems, but I didn't get into them. I had met, you see, the Tommy Bolin guy at the Rainbow. But he was a big guy. I mean, he had some weight on him. And he was looking for some very dangerous substances to put you to sleep. And I just said, you know, Dallas, we don't need this. And I just got out of there. You know, I take a drink, but come on, guys.
Well, before Deep Purple, there was one more very famous classic rock band that would have had its sights on Tony Flynn.
I played in Steppenwolf for 3 years, and this horrible talent agent just scorched and torched the name into the ground. I don't know how many Steppenwolfs there were at the end. There could have been two, and I was very depressed by that. And Goldie wanted this horrible fee. He wasn't in the group anymore to, use the name Steppenwolf. And that was my life's blood.
Tony's stint in Steppenwolf would have led him to meeting Jeff Emery, who would later go on with him to the new Deep Purple.
Jeff was an excellent keyboard player. And he played in the Iron Butterfly. And then, really very, very good man, very humble, very kind. So I enjoyed working with Jeff, and he had come on as one of the actual Steppenwolf keyboard players.
Tony talks a little bit about the beginning, getting together with Jeff Emery and figuring out what Deep Purple was all about.
We're sitting around with all this career I have from 72 all the way to the year 1980. All of a sudden, I get these album covers thrown at me in the living room of Jeff's house. And, you know, we've got some really good bands, The Police, The Pretenders, The Doobie Brothers with Mike McDonald. Everything's been cut way down. Really beautiful stuff. Elvis Costello, stiff competition, the punk rock scene. And all of a sudden, I'm handed these 20-minute guitar solo, organ solo songs. I'm like, what in the hell? Where's the music? You know, where are the songs? You know, we're going to die on stage. You know, you have to cut this down to 6 minutes. If you do a reform group with Rod, the radio people were not kind. I mean, they would blast Tony Flynn, formerly of Steppenwolf, Rod Evans, formerly of Deep Purple. Then they would throw in Paul Butterfield Blues Band, too, just to do extra damage. I mean, the promoters went wild on the radio.
Tony would have been one of the last musicians to ever work with Rod Evans. So, of course, I had to ask him, what was it like?
Yeah, I did. He's very humble, very nice man. He was working in a hospital, I remember. And he's just a very good person. Very wholesome. Eats food. you know, he's not the, he sings very well. He has a good, deep voice. I like that. And with that in mind, Rob was a very special person to me as a human being. And I met him, and we were tossing around the idea of if we do this, if we do that. And we came upon this abandoned name, which was Deep Purple, and I didn't want to touch that with a nine-yard stick.
It was a very complicated matter trying to conceive of how they could bring Deep Purple back to the mainstream with a different lineup.
The idea of using the Deep Purple name or the songs, because it was abandoned, not only was it dangerous, it was volatile. Because you're going up against groups with 3, 4, 5, 6 minute hit records. And you have to bring this group back to life. And then you need players that are at the level. You can't bring people up to this level. They have to be at that level. And then you have to advertise that these guys aren't in the band. I mean, Richie had Deep Purple, and then he got out of it. And he did Rainbow. He's an excellent musician. And he was playing with Brenda Lee and the Casuals and Deep Purple a long time ago.
Tony paints a picture of what it was like in 1980 planning this with Rod and what was going on with the rest of the former members of Deep Purple.
And then when Richie did Rainbow, it was a mess because he was in the old Pirate Sound studios. They had turned into SIR studios. Whitesnake was in Japan with this keyboard player and this drummer from Deep Purple.
So this brings up the legal questions. What was going on with the name Deep Purple? Who owned it and who could use it? Tony weighs in on his and Rod's take on the situation.
Name was loose, and it was an abandoned, legally abandoned name. And we said, well, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. I mean, you're looking into a big undertaking, you know, if we do this. We decided to do it. I don't know why, but we did it.
So they did it. They got out there, they put their band together, and they began playing shows. So I asked Tony, what were those shows like?
We weren't considered with the draw. We were considered with the quality of the group. I mean, if you're looking at an excellent or good version of Deep Purple, that's the only one you could do. You can't go out as a Deep Purple group and say, gee, I might come up to the level. You have to practice the guitar, two-hour, plugged in. You have to practice scales 2 hours after that. You have to be on the phone. You have to manage this. It's another thing. It really is. And you have to drive. You have to set up a separate rehearsal facility. A shell. You're living inside a shell where it's just the families.
But as we talked about in the last show, it wasn't just these live performances. There was actually talk of an actual album being put together by the band.
Well, I basically got funding out of the Musicas Amistaco City to put the whatever I wanted to do together at any time.
In 1980, Tony did get some recordings done, including the song All I Am Is Blue, which was intended for the new Deep Purple lineup. Rod would not be involved in these recordings.
Got to get the meaning of that deep shade of blue. Well, I got to get the feeling of that much darker you.
I have been warned about, you know, this particular group, what the replications or percussions would be.
Well, I got to know, not feeling,
was starting out from funding from Mexico, and then we got secondary funding to do Amarillo, Texas, and El Paso. So when I did the Amarillo show, I was ready to just say, screw it, you know, this isn't going to work. When I got to the dam, they lit the trash cans on fire and the fans went crazy. So this was Deep Purple. We were going out and we were doing this. But I was very hesitant for like 3 months. And then it just took off. People wanted the same promoters that were saying bad things were now saying good things. Everyone changed their story.
I asked Tony if he still kept in touch with any of the members of the new Deep Purple lineup.
No, I really don't. This is a group. This is not one guy on Skype. This is a whole group of guys. And it's a 13-person company that supports 13 people and all their families.
But as we talked about on our special, eventually the legal problems did catch up with them.
Watching a legal team come into court, I've only seen that happen once in the O.J. Simpson trial, where they hire legal attorneys. Outside of that, I've never heard of it. You only need four attorneys to sue a city.
Tony is a very humble man, and after all of these legal problems, he doesn't bear any ill will towards any of the members of Deep Purple.
You know, whoever the guys in the group, I wish him the best.
As we talked about in our special, this lineup of Deep Purple isn't always called the new Deep Purple. Sometimes it's called the fake Deep Purple. Sometimes it's called the bogus Deep Purple, a term that Tony does not like.
I'm not too thrilled with this word bogus that the guys come up with, because that in Mexico is a very serious, it's a dolo charge. And dolo has a lifelong statute writing a blank check with no money in it. You can't do that. And these guys have been doing it to me and other members of the group for 22 years.
Tony isn't one to dwell on the past.
Be real. I have to work. I have to make money. I'm in another business now, and I'm very happy playing the guitar. That ended 40 years ago.
In 1990, Tony headed into the studio and recorded an album called Angel's Breath.
No, it really didn't. Warner Curb Dick Whitehouse offered us a recording contract. And, you know, these guys were very straight people. This was Lieutenant Governor Mike Curb, California. And the William Morris Agency had us on their roster. So, gig money fun. We were doing great.
But I did have to take Tony back to the past a little bit. I needed to ask about Dick Juergens. What was up with the chainsaw?
Dick. Dick had a thing with chainsaws in hotel rooms. Let's just leave it at that, okay? And when they would call, and he'd call down to the front desk of the guests and say there was a motorcycle in the halls. I mean, it was another time back then. We had just gone from rotary dials to push buttons.
I also asked Tony about those shows in Mexico. You can find them on YouTube, and it looks like they were pretty well received, though not without their fair share of technical difficulties.
The generator was running at 40 cycles a second. So the organ was playing a D chord when I was hitting an E. So I had to tune down live in rain in August in front of the people and go through the set that way. And the promoters were 2 hours late in paying us. So that was a pretty weird show.
If you do your research on the new Deep Purple lineup, you'll find a pretty wide-ranging set of experiences from people who attended the shows. Some are pretty negative, but there's quite a few that are very positive about the shows that they attended.
But there were some good shows. I mean, we did kept the name up. We could have easily destroyed the name, but we kept it up.
Tony kept busy after legal problems caused the new Deep Purple lineup to break up. He kept in the studio and kept recording tracks. Like this one, Someone's Got a Hold, recorded in 1980. Ask Tony if he keeps in touch with Rod or if he's heard from him recently.
No, I really don't, and I respect Rod. But again and again, I respect Goldie McZon too. He's dead. I was going to do an album with Goldie, and he passed away. Rod is financially secure as a respiratory therapist. He lives in San Francisco, and hats off to him. I'm financially secure. I'm living in Redores in Mexico City, and I have my gigs. I mean, I have my jobs, and I handle money, and I'm very careful.
But was there any talk of ever getting back together with Rod?
No, just comfortable. I'm very comfortable. Rod's very comfortable. We don't want to get involved in really getting back together again. I think it would be inappropriate. To be honest with you, with Dick being dead, with a bunch of old guys getting together, you know, play a bunch of old tunes. There's wonderful new stuff out there. There's Ed Sheeran, there's James Blunt, there's new guys, Maroon 5, there's John Hyatt, all songs, beautiful stuff, alternative stuff. There's wonderful guys out in New York City, bands, party bands. They make a lot of money. You look at it from a financial view, the Broadway musicians, the banquet and party band guys in New York City working for the banquet companies, they're doing wonderful things. But I don't want to rehash an old rock group that, you know, could go nowhere. It's really crazy. It's fun. It's fun for a tribute, but, you know.
More on Tony's 1990 release, Angel's Breath.
And I came back in 90 to Fresh Compact Disc. I'd spoken to Jeff Emery, and he said there's this place that put Fresh Compact Disc. It had dropped from $10,000 to $1,000. I said, well, I'll put my hand in my pocket for that. And I did the project. It took a couple months to record, but I wrote all the parts out by hand. I remember paper, and I still write out by hand. There was another record after that, but things didn't work out. I was meant to say, I think it was Amblin Disney was asking me to work for them, and I just started working with different people in studio in the 90s. The fusion stuff, the jazz stuff, was like that LA fusion bands from 72. They're accepted in universities like USC, UCLA, upstate California, with those type of bands. They're very trendy, college-oriented times. But I learned the hard way about that type of music. I had tried out for Johnny Winter, and I was playing that type of music. And I think Rick Derringer didn't like that type of music at all, so he just, you know, said, forget it, Tony. By Steve Paul, I met Steve, Rick, and Edgar Winner. They're good guys. They're all good guys. And then my guitar teacher, buddy Matlock, loved the music. And I got Demetrio Pass and all the guys in that that came to an abrupt end because you got to work. And I started meeting everyone from Elvis impersonators to anyone just looking for work playing music. And eventually I found one straight guy, Goldie, from Steppenwolf, and we were friends forever.
I told Tony that some of his jazz fusion playing reminded me of another Deep Purple guitar player, Tommy Bolin.
Master guitar player again, but he got himself very sick. With salt and pepper, you mix the coke with the heroin. They start doing that at parties. And then, you know, I've seen this stuff at parties, but I would never take it. You know, it's just a drink. I was invited to John Miles' house, and they would have that stuff around. Drinking is fine. Some booze, eat some food first. Don't go out and have drinks at night.
That song we heard earlier, Someone's Got a Hold, well, it sounded a lot like Rod Evans. Apparently it was not.
Yeah, I really, Phil was a singer. I remember that because I had to replace Rod because I was living in Hollywood. Rod living in the valley, Jeff was in Torrance. We had constructed a room behind a garage to rehearse the Deep Purple group. And it was a very good rehearsal hall we had built. And I had to have all my players within a few blocks of my house when I had an idea, it had to be pretty quick. So I had a Studio 9, and I called in Phil, and I called in another bass player, and I called in another drummer. And songs ready to go, All Over Now, All I Am Is Blue, and a couple other songs. And then I was going to pull on the publishing from Steppenwolf if this Warner Curve didn't have anything that would pull up to speed.
And there was another singer on that song from earlier, All Over Now.
Ellen Mark, yeah, she disappeared. She sang with the Ohio Players, and then the song was ready to go. But for the Deep Purple group from before. So that was going to be one of the songs. Again, we had to cut everything down. 80 was another time. We had to cut all the songs down to 6 minutes when we played them live. Board solo, one guitar solo, one drum solo, and that's it. 90 minutes. it was just another time. You're up against the police. You're up against the Pretenders. It was another thing, you know. The 20-minute keyboard solo with the guitar solo, edging that into the song was no longer happening.
As far as all the jazz and fusion songs and all the more complicated stuff, well, Tony's keeping it a little simpler these days.
Very simple music. I think the first three songs I sent you are very simple. I just sing, play with three fingers, cut the bass track, cut the guitar track, rhythm and blues stuff, three fingers with a slide. Just rhythm and blues oriented music. I'd like a guitar player from ZZ Top. It's just really simple stuff. I mean, if you go to that, everyone will love you. But if you go over the top, boy, you're pain.
Tony's not entirely done with movies. He's done a little bit of acting and had his music in some movies as well.
And finding people that actually thing in the film business. I was lucky. I did one, Acapulco Paradise, the uncle of the kid who did the movie, did the sound for the music Roma. The Pellicula Roma, and they won a lot of Academy Awards for in this business. But it is a hard business, the film business.
Tony played quite a few live shows over the years, including with the new Deep Purple lineup. So I asked him if he missed those days on the road.
No, in fact, it's just too much traveling, too much carrying equipment, and then... you know, today and date, I drink coffee, and I drink red wine once in a while. I mean, you know, when you're older, you have to take care of your health. So it's another thing. The day further and further apart, and the Mexican economy crashed in. You know, a lot of guys are trying to make their money here in Mexico in music. Hey, get off it. Move on. You know?
So we talked for close to an hour, and it was a real pleasure talking to Tony. This is an era of Deep Purple that I've heard about and read about for years, but never really truly understood. I think there's a lot of people out there that feel the same way, that don't really understand the inner workings of how this was all put together. Deep down, Tony was just part of this band and somebody who really loved music and wanted to perform. So as we close this special episode, I'll leave you with a 1980 recording that Tony did of the Deep Purple classic Hush. Thank you for listening to the Deep Purple Podcast. If you like what you hear and would like more episodes in the future, please donate on Patreon to support the show. You can also give us a rating on iTunes to help new people discover the show. You can follow us on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for show updates. See deeppurplepodcast.com for more details. Thank you for listening.